This is Raphonix After Hours.
Hello, and welcome to a technologically advanced Rack Addicts After Hours. This is episode 84, brought to you through the amazing sound of the Rodecaster Pro. Please sponsor us, Rode. We'd love a bit of cash or something. I'm joined by Pete and Luke, our favourite podcast people. It's wonderful to have you here. And also a friend of Pete's has joined in, so we've got an audience. Hello, audience. How are you doing? Okay. It's time for a weekly update, of course. And actually, there's been some action in my corner of the world. It's a rare thing. It happens. I've got a bike ride. It's not a bike race. It's a bike ride, an organised cycling event, which will hopefully be dry this weekend. 80 kilometres in the South Downs. And I hope I survive.
80?
80, 8-0. And there's a 21% hill, which I'm very, very scared of.
Ooh. Which hill is it? Is it a notable hill?
It probably is, but I'm not going to think about it too much until I'm faced with it, you know. But that'll be cool. I did manage to purchase a bike GPS made by a company called Wahoo, the Wahoo Element Bolt. Which surprised me that I managed to get one, because it's out of stock everywhere, because it's probably another victim of the old silicon shortage that's going round. But I've got that, so I can now cycle in the rain, which I will probably need to. I won't have to sacrifice my phone to the gods of rain. The other thing that has happened is, I think I've told you, Pete, I have been attempting to escape YouTube somewhat, because it's an addiction, and I've revived an old hobby that sounds like this. To people that don't know, that's the sound of a Rubik's Cube. Actually, way back, I used to be into Rubik's Cubes and other twisty puzzles. I find exercise is a different corner of the brain. You know when you do those... Sometimes you do these tests at school, maybe they're IQ tests, and they give you these grids, patterns. They'll go, here are four shapes. What is the next one? It's that kind of area.
Sort of tessellating or transforming... Mm. But it involves some kind of equation, I feel, but like a pattern-based equation. I'd never, no, I couldn't do those.
It's interesting because it's a different way of thinking that is definitely not something I do while scrolling through various websites and engaging none of my brain at all. So it's felt like mental exercise. But it's good, refreshing. That and reading a book that Luke so kindly recommended last week, Rendezvous with Rama.
Oh, yes.
Jump back an episode if you want to have a listen to that particular spacey bit about extrasolar objects, and also an incredible discussion on Dune, the Frank Herbert book, and Flims coming out soon. The kittens are doing well, and that's been my week.
What are their names?
Miso and Mochi. There's a Japanese confectionery theme.
Excellent.
And they're both girls. Anyway, Pete, what have you been up to apart from, at last, upgrading the technical department of Rack Addicts After Hours?
Yes, well, apart from that, the frugality of last week has gone out the window completely.
As it tends to do.
Yes. So
Bring us the bad news.
I grabbed the DivKit LFO that we discussed. The Oct.
Brilliant little, was it eight LFOs, isn't
eight
it?
Eight LFOs mm-hmm. that sort of cycle and then go out of sequence, and I'm having great fun with that. But I also grabbed a Happy Nerding.
Ooh, FX-Aid?
FX-Aid.
Oh, yeah, that's on my multi-effects list. Really great. Have you tried the Shimmer yet?
I've gone through some of the presets, and I don't know which one's which. I know ones I like when I hear
them. Shimmer is quite glorious from the demos I've heard.
Well, I believe they tried to model them off the Strymon Big Sky.
Not a bad place to start.
That's what they claim. But I wasn't aware of that particular module until last week anyway.
Oh,
it sort of somehow just appeared on my radar, so to speak, and just had to get one.
Well, it's 4HP and it's stereo, so it's pretty efficient, isn't it?
Yeah, so it might even possibly displace the clouds.
Oh.
Maybe.
There's a different kind of overlap there, because you'll sacrifice your granular a bit.
At the moment, I'm actually running the rings into the clouds, then into the FX-Aid.
That is a glorious ambient signal chain there.
And then manipulating the whole lot with the DivKit.
That's a brilliant four-module challenge, if I've ever heard one.
So that's producing quite a few interesting results. Mm. But I can't wait to actually get them all out into their own case, and then I can take the unit into other environments, because I've been using it in the same location for quite some time. I don't know if you've found that when you move stuff around, you get different inspirations.
That's definitely happened in not just life in general, but especially in modular. Just a rearrange can open things up quite a lot.
Other than that, I've started construction of the M185 sequencer.
Nice one. Going well so far?
Very slowly. I'm absolutely creeping through the BOM carefully, measuring all the components.
Don't want your
testing them.
Hex mix. Flash
yes, packs. I don't want to recreate that. I don't see that it's a particularly problematic build anyway, because there's all of 5 transistors on there and all the ICs can be in standoffs anyway. So hopefully if I do it diligently, it'll function when it's finished.
Wonderful. How close are you to actually getting the case made?
Not at all.
Ah.
apart from that fact, I have ordered some of the...
Well, other than the rails that you've already got.
Yeah. I've ordered the hinges and the fasteners.
We've gone for butterfly latch
Nothing
style.
Nothing that
things.
Exotic. Just sort of a flip.
Yeah, standard
I
stuff.
I don't know what the technical name for it is.
Flippy doodahs, I believe.
Yeah, flippy yes. thing. So a flippy catch. When I get the actual form of the case, then I can decide on what protective cornering I can use, because there is quite an array available. You can have plastic,
Certainly.
You can have steel, you can have stacking, non-stacking, large balls, et cetera, et cetera.
We always love a large ball.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Luke, what have you been up to?
Lots of things.
Mm.
I tell you what, it's been feeling a bit 2019 in my corner. I've been busy.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Musically busy.
A little bit of that, yes. Although we're on a break this week, hence why we are here on a Thursday.
Mm.
Breaking for holiday. I think our engineer, bassist, individual has gone on a little camping trip, so he's having a nice time.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it's just that I'm back at the office, which is interesting and novel.
Good, interesting and novel.
Yeah, I actually like it more than I thought I would. There's a lot more space than I'd imagined there would be, and the IT has improved, and the people are fun to talk to.
That was going well then.
Yeah.
Love it.
Not bad at all. If anything, it's actually easier to get certain things done. I loved working from home and I enjoyed working with my new company when I worked from home, but sometimes it's just easy to just kind of go, hey, can you help me with this? And you don't have to start a video conference with them.
Yeah, they can walk over and look at what you're looking at.
Yeah, come down
How
to
strange.
My cubicle. So apart from that, I've been playing Mass Effect 2.
I actually just started Mass Effect 1 again. Lovely.
Is this legendary?
No, normal.
Well, that's fine.
Just, yeah, the old one, which doesn't run any higher than 1280.
Oh.
Hang on, what's the resolution? That's the one below. Yeah, 1280 by 720. I can't get it to work any higher than that. It's vintage.
That's interesting. What are you playing it on?
A PC. It's the Steam version. And
okay.
I couldn't even get 1080p to work. So I've got a 2K and a 1080p monitor, and it's just not happy at all.
That's
oh,
really
well.
Strange.
But tell us about Mass Effect 2 Legendary Edition.
Well, I was just thinking there must be a mod for that, but never
Probably.
Mind. We'll come back to that one. It's good. It's different. It's not changed much as the series goes. There's a little bit of reskinning here, because it is showing its age a tiny bit, I guess. It had a lot of controversy because they changed some camera angles for certain characters during certain conversations, and it prompted a little bit of a gamer backlash.
Yeah.
I
think I know which ones you mean.
Yeah.
I know you mean.
I'm personally with BioWare on that one, because the conversation that people were most upset about is when someone's telling you about their terrible, terrible father and the awful things he did to them.
Yep.
I don't think it's a good time for butts. But, you know, whatever. So let's not wade into that one. But it's a good game. It's a very different game to Mass Effect 1. It's not an RPG. It's a shooter with RPG elements in it. And it's just a bit different, but it's gorgeous and it's fun. And I spent a lot of time doing not so much the story, but just going through all the really silly bits with all the characters that you can do and enjoying the exploration side of it, which is different to Mass Effect 1. Not as, like, there's less to do, but it's much more optimized.
Did you mention they had tweaked the combat situation?
Not so much in 2. 2 was basically set the standard for what the trilogy would become anyway.
1 is weird.
Yeah.
Trying to drag yourself out of cover. Shepard just goes, no, we're staying here.
And
of course.
It just, yeah, the guns are, some of them are semi-unusable.
Mm.
They ported over a lot of stuff from Mass Effect 2 into Mass Effect 1 Legendary Edition, and it's great. You know, I think you'd enjoy it if you played it on Legendary, because it makes Mass Effect 1 a much more modern shooting experience,
yeah.
RPG experience. It's just really a lot more fun. And also, when I played it on the Xbox 360 in 2007, which is when it came out,
oh wow,
a lot of textures popped in and out frequently.
Yeah.
It was terrible for it. So playing it in, you know, on my, I've got a 1440 monitor, playing it on that was just great. Really does look like you should have done back then.
Nice one. There was a discussion we were having in the kitchen before Pete went, no, just stop, just save it for the podcast. We were talking about whiskey.
Ah, yes.
My parents live near the Cotswold Distillery, an English whiskey distillery. Oh, mm-hmm. they do gin, of course, because they can. I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, they came out with their first, which is an Odyssey barley whiskey. So that's normally reserved for the beer production world. Yeah. So that's a little unusual, but it's just really, really solid. As an unpeated whiskey, I'm a big fan. But I went up to their shop and had a taste just prior to purchasing the peated version, or aged in a ex-peated cask version, for my dad's birthday, and it was refined, sophisticated, delicious. Not absolutely blow your head off, straying into Octomore territory. It's not an obviously big peat, Talisker or Lagavulin or something. Mm. It was there, and it was really enjoyable.
That's a brand, you know. Big Peat is a brand.
Yeah, Peathead is one as well.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking the same thing. I think Big Peat is a bottle by Peathead.
Oh, it could be. I don't know. But all these words are familiar.
Yes, we'll get told off in the comments. It's all good.
Oh, so sorry.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mentioned that I'd recently come across a classic laddie, Brook Laddie, which is spelt, if you know, you're English, it's spelt Bruichladdich, let's be real. Oh, I'm sorry, Scotland, it is. My grandfather is looking at me from Glasgow right now, and he's like, not very happy. It is unpeated. But I just had this really distinct taste of like smoke and petrol. And I was like, oh, wow, I haven't had a peated whiskey in a while. And I turned the canister over and I was like, and I still haven't. It says unpeated on the side. And I thought, this is an incredibly smoky whiskey, an unpeated liquid.
Wait, would you know where that flavour's originating?
Don't know. No, I couldn't read anything into it that was, I think it's just ex-bourbon casks or oak, well, I think, actually, no, sorry. I think it's first fill oak casks. So nothing, I mean, nothing that would give it a distinctly smoky flavour. It's one of those things with whiskey where it's a little bit of the aqua vitae, I suppose. I'm sure you could go into it and figure out what scientifically was doing those things, but I couldn't tell off the top of my head. For one thing, I'm actually more of a sherry bomb fan, to be perfectly honest with you.
Right.
So I you know, I buy Arran, I buy a Glenfarclas, Glendronach, that sort of thing. So that's kind of more my speed. But yeah, Classic Lady was nice, didn't disappoint, but I think it's one that I'll probably share more than say for myself, just because it's not quite up my street, but still a really good scotch.
But you're sharing it, you're not giving it away, so that's definitely,
well,
definitely,
I mean,
good.
I can give it away.
Ooh, delicious. Brook Laddie and Lagavulin were my two favourites when I worked in the craft beer and wine place. Yeah. Purely because of the different pronunciations. Mm-hmm. Brook Laddie more. I think the worst was Bruichladdich, which it's like they were trying to sort of make it a bit French, which was bizarre. And Lagavulin.
Ah, right. Okay.
That was fun.
So I had a conversation with a friend of mine, who got me into whiskey, who is much further down the winding path of knowledge and intrigue than I am. But at the time, he was like, I want to try this whiskey called Lagavulin. And I was like, I think it's pronounced Lagavulin. And he was like,
Lagavulin.
Lagavulin. And he said, no, it's definitely not. And he went on YouTube and showed me a video of a Scotsman saying Lagavulin. And I was like, oh dear. Oh well.
Oh no.
I tried letting down the heritage.
Well, please, of course, find us on Facebook at Rack Addicts UK and recommend some of your favourite whiskies, because why not?
That would be good.
We do enjoy them. Or gins. You like a bit of gin sometimes as well.
I'm partial to anything alcoholic.
And before we jump into the couple of bits of news that we've got, we had a modcaf. It happened yesterday. It was brilliant. We did tickets, though you didn't have to pay for the tickets, which was nice because I felt like people then put it in the calendar more and actually everybody turned up. We saw lots of friendly faces and it was great. Not that many people bringing hardware this time, so we had to sort of blag a bit. Our Cyber End Powers, our good friend, did bring his quite vast collection of Behringer modules, in fact. And he's been using the ARP 2500 flavoured stuff, and it's pretty good. He reckons it sounds quite a lot better, and it's all actually Eurorack voltage, so it's more compatible. But he was a big fan of the ring mod. But that was interesting. We had Akira doing an excellent demonstration of the current rabbit hole of Teletype, Just Friends, a Mungo Enterprises digital delay. We had some wonderful noise there. I had a jam with a gentleman who had a TD3.
Nice.
I was borrowing somebody's modular, so I didn't know it very well. So I just made a kick drum and couldn't figure out how to sync them, so I just tapped it with my hand.
You were a drummer for a day.
I was a drummer for a day, the least high-tech sequencer in the world, the human being. But it was good fun, and we've got another one happening on the 8th of next month. Pete, the 8th of September, he's shaking his head, he's nodding at the same time. Will you be ready?
Hopefully.
Hopefully. That's a stunning commitment there from Pete. So we'll move into the newsworthy section. today on What's Behringer Done Now? So they've given the rights to the Oberheim brand back to Tom. I didn't realise they had it, but there we go. That's happened. That's great. And they're quoted as saying, it's the right thing to do, because they're trying to get positive press. Wonderful. And on a similar line, Auratone have successfully defended their trademark. There is a Behringer sound cube, which now must be branded Behringer. Behringer. But yeah, it's good. The trademark is back with the rightful owners, which is a family business, actually.
I had thought for a moment, because we got them into the shop, that they had actually bought the brand. But obviously
I was
not
under the impression as well, because they said Auratone on them and then Behringer on the back, and we were thinking, hang on. But no, they just went and did it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not
I know they were
great.
Considerably cheaper than the real thing.
I don't know that better really matters in the sound cube world,
no,
to be
not
honest.
Really. In fact, don't you want it to be awful?
Yeah, all you'd want is reliability, so it doesn't explode and sounds terrible for many, many years to come. In the slightly more interesting, let's actually go to not what's Behringer done now, but what's Behringer teased us that they're going to make now. The Pro 16 is a completed prototype now, so that's a Prophet 5 flavour, but 16 voices. Just, you know, sticking the fingers up at sequential there, because they can. Will it come out at some point? Maybe. Will it be all right? Probably. Will it work? Potentially. We'll leave that one there and we'll let you know later.
Got to wonder whether they're actually going to bring all of these prototypes to production.
It's going to be a big catalogue if they do. A lot of synths.
So I have a question for those of us who are the most basic kind of sequencer.
No, you are the most advanced type of sequencer.
Flattery.
With the most feel.
Flattery will get you everywhere. What is the massive difference between a Behringer Prophet and a sequential Prophet in terms of, like, is it going to be one of those things where it's a little bit of the je ne sais quoi, it is just better made, or is it there truly is just cheaper parts and they're awful and they sound crap?
We'll start with build quality, because that's the really easy one.
Yeah.
Behringer will be worse.
Yeah.
It just will be. So they use super cheap parts because they can, huge quantities, quality control issues everywhere. In terms of sound, that's where it's going to get trickier, because what they do a lot of the time is clone the circuits perfectly. So in theory, all the resistors and stuff, they're going to be the same values. They'll likely move, well, the original would be all through-hole type components, and there might not even be that many PCBs involved. There'd be a mess of wires, and they're quite dense, whereas Behringer's recreations are almost exclusively going to be surface mount made by computers, pick-and-place machines, and then it's up to you to decide what sounds better. What do you think, Pete?
There's just no way it's going to be anywhere near the quality because of the price point they're aiming at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I personally think that Sequential charged a lot for the recent release of the Prophet 5 and Prophet 10, and I think they specifically did that because they could.
Right.
They knew there was a latent demand. We saw that when they came into stock. There was sort of a lot bought, but I don't know if many have sold recently. I think those who are going to buy,
they've got them already, haven't they?
They've bought them. They've got their Prophet 5 or their Prophet 10, and that's it. I'm not sure if we're really going to see a lot more sold from now on. I mean, the odd one, but not a massive number anyway.
In the same triangle, I suppose, there's always the question of, oh, but the plugin sounds just as good.
Right.
And yeah, it does.
Does it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, all right, okay, fine. Okay, better question. Can you do the same things with it, with a plugin?
Most likely.
Okay.
And probably more, because you can chuck DAW automation
at it all. That's true, actually.
Which is great.
Rather than sampling it, yeah. Okay.
So aficionados will be able to tell the difference between the original, the remake, the Behringer, and the plugin.
Sure.
Probably, if they're playing it, because of how it might respond in a certain way or something. Stick it in a mix and no one's ever going to know. So if you're making money with it, who cares? If you just want the joy of owning an exquisite object, as Pete and I have extolled many times, then potentially you might want to go for the real deal.
I suppose it's one of those things where engineering and artistry kind of cross paths. It's like this person or this company or these designers have spent time creating this circuit that makes this particular noise. It's very interesting. Everyone wants to copy it. But what gets used in the industry more often than not, I would assume, but possibly not more often than not, maybe just some of the time, is that it is a plugin or whatever, mm-hmm. because someone wants that Iconic Prophet sound but doesn't have $2,000 or more.
Or even they don't want to rack up a huge bill of rentals for That's grabbing true. All these vintage synths if they're doing studio time.
Although I tell you what, if I was doing studio time that I had a larger budget for, because I was going to say unlimited, but it's not 1989 anymore, I would definitely rent real synths, 100%.
There is that thing about using hardware,
yeah,
as we've discussed many times.
Having worked with Eddie and his Monologue, they're just fantastic things to have around.
And like the Monologue isn't even a high-end synth. It's super entry-level, but it's great. It was my first proper synthesizer. Really good.
Are we thinking of the same one, the Silver Curve with the wooden sides? Minilogue.
Also excellent. And yes. Still very entry level, but just
fair.
It has that vibey delay, which is technically bad in sure. inverted commas, but it just adds character because it's got that little bit of noise in there.
All of the Grove Bass Mixtape Volume 2, all of those weird sounds are either his Minilogue or weird things in an OP1 that he's played back. That's just great.
We do have another bit of news before we move on. And this is actual kind of interesting news. The IntelliGel 1U range, small, space-efficient modules, they now have a whole VCO in that lineup, which is cool. Let me try and find the HP. 1U by 14 HP. But of course, that is LFO or VCO. You've got a little switch. You also have an octave switch, plus and minus two octaves, pitch control, a pitch and sync input, and then sine, triangle, saw, and square outputs. And I believe it's analog. It is. Triangle core, good tracking. I mean, what more could you want?
So remind me again, who's 1U fits with who's 1U? Because there's two different standards.
I don't actually know. So Pulp Logic is one. IntelliGel is another. I've got Modular Grid open. Let's have a look, because it has the height, 1U, and then you can kind of specify if it's compatible with one or the other. Yeah, I think those are the two formats. Slightly different dimensions, potentially different power as well. Pulp Logic and IntelliGel, I think most people, because you can get things like the 1U Ornament and Crime, which is a brilliant idea, most people seem to be making new ones for the IntelliGel format. Because of the popularity of the cases.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, so there's Ritual Electronics do some stuff. IntelliGel, funnily enough, make a lot for their own format. For example, the Zeroscope was originally a VPME.de, the Euclidean Circles guy. That was his project until, I think, sort of handed that off to IntelliGel for that format. After Later Audio, I believe they're IntelliGel. Mostly small manufacturers, but there's lots of really cool little odds and bods. So if you have a really big case, for example, like the Moth, if you were rebuilding it again, depending on how long your patch cables like to be and what you like where, can be handy to have that 1U row right in the middle for attenuators, VCAs, utilities, bits and pieces. Not that you need it.
And Clicks and Clocks, where I tend to get my rails from, are now doing a 1U
Excellent.
Setup.
I think I asked you ages ago when you were talking about your portable case whether you were going to do a 1U row.
Well, I haven't opted for it. It's just two rows of 3U.
Just the two. I think while it can sort of help you be a bit efficient and use your full-size 3U HP for the more interesting stuff, it does end up being kind of expensive. As well, even more expensive than it needs to be. But it's an option, and if you like it, it's there. So, from modular stuff, synthy stuff, we're going to go in a rocket ship. Vertically, probably. But either way, it's time for
Luke's Spacey Bit.
So we're going to talk about the antics of a certain Russian module attached to a certain International Space Station today.
Ah, I did see a headline. Take us through it.
So the Nauka module, which is the new Russian attachment to the International Space Station, had a bit of an accident in that it fired its thrusters in such a way as to cause the International Space Station to rotate on its axis by 540 degrees.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah, it rolled over completely 1.5 times.
How quickly?
At a speed of about 0.5 degrees per second. So not very fast.
But still, that's quite a lot of movement in space when you didn't want it.
Oh, yeah. Especially when the functioning of your station requires in a certain orientation being held at all times to maximize solar exposure. And also there's another good reason why they need to point down. I forget why off the top of my head, but it's supposed to stay in a certain orientation and that's it. A great amount of energy is expended in keeping it pointing in its orientation because, of course, the space station is moving around the Earth. It's accelerating away from the Earth permanently. It's in orbit, right? So its orientation is always facing in the same direction. It has to rotate as it goes around the Earth to continue pointing down.
Mm-hmm.
So a great deal of energy is spent keeping it stationary relative to the plane of the sphere of the Earth as it journeys around. So this is obviously not ideal, especially given that it's quite embarrassing for Roscosmos that they attached a new thing to the international project and it just kind of broke.
Was there some kind of interplanetary slap on the wrist?
Well, no, actually, NASA have issued a statement saying that they have full confidence in Roscosmos and you know, these things just unfortunately sometimes happen. I mean, look at Mars. We have a 50% track record, I think it is, success rate of getting things down onto the red planet. It's just hard to do. Space is not easy.
That's nice of them. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also just a little bit of politicking, but at the end of the day, something went wrong, they fixed it, no one died. I don't think it's worth getting out of their tree. There's too much aggro between America and Russia as it is anyway. I think it's nice that they didn't just fan the flames.
Nice one.
And I always like to see solidarity among scientists anyway.
Yeah.
The cause of the issue was purportedly a software glitch, which is just really kind of worrying in my respect.
Now, yeah.
I'm a massive computer advocate. I love automation. I don't mind algorithms, really, if they're going to spend loads of money on advertising to me things that I'm interested in buying. I'm not too worried about them having my data, but that's a different conversation.
Mm.
The thing is that when you are in a can in orbit full of air and things start doing things of their own accord, that would worry me.
Just a tad.
Yes. The problem is now fixed. The thrusters stopped firing after the, I think an hour after the incident occurred. A combination of the existing Russian Zvezda service module and the Progress 78, which is a ship that's attached to the space station that's just kind of stayed there since it was put there. Those balanced out the station and brought it back to its original orientation. So crisis averted. Nobody was hurt. Apparently some of the astronauts didn't even notice until warnings started flagging.
It happened. It's now not happening. Excellent.
It's just unfortunate because Nauka has had so many problems. It was delayed for a long time anyway. It was one of these spacecrafts that's been permanently in production for a very long time, much like the JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope. And then it had problems getting up to its correct orbital height and so on when it launched last week. So it's just been one of those things where it would be really nice if they didn't have all these problems stacking up. And then just when they finally got it attached, it decided to go and roll the space station. Fortunately, it wasn't a particularly damaging event and nobody was injured and the ISS is unharmed. They're going to dig in to find out exactly what caused the issue. But as far as we understand it, for now, crisis averted. One humorous thing is that a lot of YouTube videos have been surfacing where people have modeled the orientation switch, if you like, which is obviously a very polite scientific word for cock up. And the data that they're using, when you feed it into a like an orbital model program, makes it look as though the space station has gone absolutely crazy, like something in a video game, just rolling around like crazy with the sort of breakneck g-force that would definitely rattle around our astronauts like peas in a pod. That is inaccurate. The reason for that is because sometimes when people have been putting those videos up, they haven't accounted for the pole switch that would take place if you rotated the space station through its axis 180 degrees, as far as the computer can understand it. In terms of what we saw, it literally just rolled. But that would flip the poles because it rolled along a weird axis. It didn't roll along the polar axis. So that's generated a lot of really funny videos where people are saying, good grief, it rocketed around like crazy. No, it rolled 540 degrees, it's fine. But yeah, hopefully that won't happen again. I get the feeling that the ISS could do with a quiet year after the one it's had.
Yeah. What do we have, that leak a while ago, didn't we?
The persistent Russian leak. Mm-hmm. Then we had micrometeorites. Yes, lots of things like that. It has unfortunately delayed a lot of things. There's going to be a series of 11 spacewalks that will take place to completely satisfy the setup requirements before Nauka can be fully operational. It's a new science module that the Russians have put up, so that's going to take some time to obviously do that. That's pushed back that schedule. There are other experiments planned on the ISS that have been pushed back, and there was a trip to the ISS planned to take place last week for the Boeing Starliner. So that has had to be postponed. It should have been taking place yesterday on the 3rd, but I get the feeling that we'll see it very soon. Yeah, it's just one of those things where vital scientific experiments are pushed back. It's always a shame because they're always fighting against time. The ISS and all of those instruments will be in operation for a finite amount of time. So it is a shame whenever things get pushed back because it does potentially mean that certain science won't even happen.
Hmm.
But hopefully that won't be the case.
Space-time not the space-time continuum, but space-time is expensive.
Yes.
Just a little.
That could be some sort of... There's a physics joke in there. Time in space costs money or something.
Yeah.
I'd find that equation.
We could find out how much of the most basic of rentable... Obviously, human beings on Earth can't just rent ISS time, but we could see how much of the most basic thing we could afford.
Well, I remember seeing some buzz a while ago about Tom Cruise going to do a film on the ISS, wasn't
he? What a massive waste of money.
Well, yes. I mean, he must do all his own stunts and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows?
Who knows indeed.
So that's space this week.
That's the bassy spit.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Well, at the end of these episodes, we tend to give you a bit of a recommendation of some multimedia, funnily enough. The miscellaneous multimedia recommendation, as we do call it, because we're bad at alliteration and we never thought up a better title for it, and it's stuck and it's too late because we're 84 episodes in.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. I believe last week I recommended 23 Hanging Trees. Is it 23? Either way, I've been going down the YouTube rabbit hole, as I said. I'm trying not to, but it's happening anyway, and I can't stop. Please help me, somebody. But here's another modular YouTuber. Another in the camp of Teletype, Just Friends, you know, the mannequins, Monome, or Monome, I don't know. That corner of the stranger corner of the strange world of modular. Anyway, I'm rambling. This chippity chap is called R.P. Gould. That's R.P.Gould, G-O-U-L-D. I have enjoyed videos such as The Castle, which is the Instro, Harmonegg and Psych sort of demo patch around those, featuring the Gentleman's Cat, which we always like in the modular YouTube world. Extra ones such as the Eurorack Mannequin's Family Garden, and things like that. R.P. Gould, mostly ambient, experimentational bits and pieces. It's good fun. Check them out. Who's next?
You can go if you like.
Yes, you can like. Go like. So off you go.
Talking about sibilance there. So I have two, if I may. One is a...
Of course you can.
An individual video, so that doesn't really count, but it is absolutely worth your time. So we'll start with this one. This is by a pianist called DJA28. A pianist called DJA28. He put a video up that I was browsing metal covers of Pokemon theme tunes.
As one does of an evening.
I was nostalgic. Someone mentioned Pokemon Yellow on Discord, and I thought, you know what? I remember listening to a rock version of that music. And I found something better. This is a piano rendition of the Pokemon Red, Green, Blue, Yellow Trainer Battle and Victory theme. And that sounds fine. Just watch it. It's tremendous. The speed and energy that goes into this piece, and he plays all of the weird 8-bit cadences. Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. And of course caps it off with the little victory theme halfway through the bar, which is just peak video game. It sounds just like the real thing but on piano. So absolutely must check that out. If you can do one thing for the Rack Addicts crew, if you like us, if you listen to us, please watch that video. It will blow you away. The guy has tremendous piano talent and he requires more views, frankly. The other one, which is a bit more relaxed and fun and interesting, is a gaming channel, a little bit of meme culture, a little bit of game culture, called The Spiffing Brit, who I haven't recommended before, but I have recommended people in his stable and in his field of work. He does a series where he takes games, mostly strategy games, but all sorts really, and he, generally speaking, finds ways to break them or find exploits that are perhaps built in but not intended. Such things as include how to get off of RimWorld, which is a game where you run a colony in excruciating detail with the intense purpose of escaping the hellish land that you've landed on and bringing your colonists back home to whatever planet they came from. You start at the Stone Age and work up, basically. It's very grim and it's very, like I say, there's minute detail involved. He runs an organ harvesting version of that game and it's a viable way to do it. And he often introduces his videos with RimWorld is a perfectly balanced game with no exploits.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Yes.
I might have come across one of those by accident.
Yeah, he's good fun. He does all sorts of things. Skyrim, niche games.
It's the kind of, you know, send this guy a review copy at your own risk.
Exactly. Yeah. He will find a way to break your game. I don't understand people do that because it requires a level of metagaming that I don't have the brains for.
A lot of time and experimentation, I imagine.
Yes. He also published a humorous video recently where he despite his intelligence, got scammed and into deleting his YouTube channel. Fortunately, YouTube keeps a backup of all these things, but he posted up a hilarious video explaining the kerfuffle and admitting his own mistakes and just kind of spread the word that there are quite good scammers out there now that are doing things like targeting content creators.
They just gotta keep getting better or worse.
So that's the Spiffing Brit. He has a comedy British accent. He is British, but it's a very comic British accent. It's even more British than us. And
if you can imagine.
I know. And it's worth a watch or a listen or both. It's one of those channels that's listenable, but obviously the video works too.
Wonderful. Pete, you're holding a suspicious piece of paper. I'm quite scared.
Just so that I don't lose my train of thought.
Okay, I was worried.
Choo-choo.
Fire away.
Right, this week I've been immersing myself in the world of the Victoria and Albert Museum via their YouTube website.
Wonderful place.
So the V&A, as they like to abbreviate their name, for those of our listeners who are unaware or don't know what the Victoria and Albert Museum is or what they do. The Victoria and Albert Museum described themselves as the world's leading museum of art and design. It was opened in 1852 and houses 2.27 million items.
That's a few.
Yes. So their channel mainly focuses on individual objects in each video. And in a lot of cases, it's about either looking at the craftsmanship that put the object together. And in many cases, the craftsmanship still exists. So they feature a artisan actually recreating or creating a similar object. Or they're not conservators as such. They're sort of artists in residence who will actually copy, study the item, analyze the techniques that were used when it was created and try and recreate it and try and produce a copy of the object. So again, it's another one of these channels which features videos of people doing things exceedingly well. Again, and we know
the
how
artisans,
much we like. Yeah, we know how much we like that. It's very therapeutic and relaxing.
Yeah.
Again, the usual thing: no fear that it's going to go terribly wrong.
All the confidence in that person's skill.
So I would highly recommend it. Yeah, there's quite a variety of stuff that goes from sort of very fine woven silks through to ceramics and woodwork as well.
Wonderful stuff. We do enjoy these crafts people-y things, so if you have any more recommendations to feed our addiction, please chuck them in the comments on Facebook. Find us on Instagram. You know, it's Rack Addicts UK. We're out there. Come and find us. We miss you. But we'll catch you next time, I'm sure. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you in episode 85. Farewell.